Hey, uplifters. I want to take a minute to talk about something personal to me. In my 40s, I started noticing my hair was shedding more. So a couple of months ago, I started using Nutrafol. I'm already seeing so much less shedding. And my teenage daughter, who notices absolutely everything, keeps commenting on how thick my hair looks. As someone who's built my career around rigorous science, I super love that Nutrafol was the first brand to clinically study hair thinning on menopausal women, which is why I am so proud to have them as a sponsor. Nutrafol takes a whole body approach to hair health, supporting you throughout your life stages. You can see thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code UPLIFTERS.
Hala Alian. She writes about the atrocities and the dreams deferred from love-torn relationships as a mother, author, curator, anthropologist, and psychologist. She is a cultural worker who remains a beacon of resilience to us all. I love how she does not muss or fuss over genre, which is to say, our stories belong everywhere.
Welcome to the Uplifters podcast, where every week I get the great privilege of talking to a woman who's doing big, brave work in the world and who generously shares her process and mindset with us, so that we can all do big, brave things in our worlds too. Today, I'm talking to Hala Alian. She's a Palestinian-American poet, writer, professor, and clinical psychologist based in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Hala, thank you for taking time out of your busy world to hang out with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Such a joy. I'm so excited about this.
Me too.
You wear a lot of hats, a poet, a novelist, a memoirist, a clinical psychologist, a mom, a Palestinian-American identity, a Brooklynite identity. You've lived between so many different places. You've spoken so many different languages, had so many different experiences. So if you were to introduce yourself,
That's good.
How would you do that?
You know, there's actually an exercise that I'll sometimes give in the cross-cultural therapy class that I teach. That's like you write the 5 identifiers that you most strongly connect to at this moment in your life. And that's like really crucial because that highlights positionality and how what's essential for us changes over time. And then you cross out one of them and then you're left with the top 4. And that I should make you do it. And then you cross out another one. And then you're left with 3. And then you cross out another one. And then you're left with 1. And usually it's the 3 to 2 and 2 to 1 that are the hardest. And so as you were saying that, that's what I was thinking of. Because I was like, I think in this moment, I think my role and capacity as a mother feels really central. I think that's kind of been taking center stage. And as a Palestinian. And that has obviously everything to do with the circumstances. And I think, you know, the roles of like writer and professor and teacher, or like, you know, community member, all of those things, those feel kind of like they've been evenly consistent in terms of like where they are in my life for the last however many years. But I definitely think the last few years, because also the like both Gaza and my daughter's birth were not, I mean, they didn't overlap exactly. My daughter was like a year and a half when October 7th happened, but like it's that role of like really gelling into what it means to be a mother has not felt separate from Palestine for me. And so that's been really interesting, like to mother while watching and witnessing and like trying to understand how, as a member of a diaspora with all these privileges, what can I do? How can I be, you know, of service? It's been so salient. Because I think in a lot of ways, Palestine has been superimposed on everything I've done maternally too, for good and for bad, you know? And so, yeah, those are the two that I would be like, yeah, I think I would say those have felt really central in this day.
It was so fun. Maybe it's not the right word. Watching your process through that Because it seemed as though the distinction was the degree of change and transformation that was happening.
I think like the Palestinianness in general, and I think people of color, like BIPOC folks, people that belong to marginalized identities, this is true for all. Like, I don't think this is just a Palestinian thing, but is that there is something about the salience of that identity that has a lot to do with the urgency of the moment, right? So like, I would love to, this is a big, larger conversation about identity politics, but it's like, my identity is foregrounded, not by myself necessarily. You know what I mean? Like, it's the thing that is, it's also like put upon me, given where we live and given like, you know, political structures and power structures and whatever. And so it's interesting to have to kind of continuously renegotiate what it means to be stepping into an identity that you're also, there's also all of these like presupposed like projections onto, you know, that are like not necessarily coming out of you. So it's like my relationship to my Palestinianness is something that has been really complicated and changed depending on whether I'm living in Beirut or living, you know what I mean, living in an Arab world, living here, if I'm traveling to Europe, like it really shifts. And its salience, of course, which is, I mean, tragic, has been made so visceral in the last like couple of years. But even before that, it was that's what's interesting about positionality. Like it really changed depending on where my feet happen to be touching on this earth.
That word salience is so rich. What does it mean to you? It's so rich.
It's like how relevant, how, again, like visceral, how embodied it is, you know, how much it's something that I'm thinking about on a day to day. There is not, I mean, every day, multiple times a day, I am thinking about Gaza in particular, Palestine in general, what it means for me to inhabit this identity. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it enough? Like, so I think there's like, that's the salience. Whereas, you know, there have certainly been years and eras of my life, particularly when I lived in the Arab world, where I didn't really, and that's not to say it wasn't a complicated identity there in many ways, but it was like, it was different. It wasn't something I was having to negotiate in the same way. Similar with motherhood. Like, I think about mothering in some capacity or my daughter in some capacity, I mean, on an hourly, multiple times an hour basis, even if I'm not next to her. And that has just become, that is so infused in my being at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The four words that came up as I heard that were urgency and importance playing a huge factor in that, but also interdependence.
Yes, totally. Yeah. 100%. And really negotiating what that interdependence looks like in both of the roles, you know?
Yeah, I bet. And in terms of being so deeply engaged in both of those and actively engaged, while at the same time trying to just survive as a human.
Totally. And that starts to feel, I mean, those things feel interlinked, right? So like survival as a human on a day-to-day basis, watching like eradication and erasure of Palestinians, that is the stakes of that change. You know what I mean? Because then you're, and then there also isn't a day that goes by that you're not like, my brand of existence is relatively unruffled. You know what I mean? Like it's like, there's a fair amount of ease in it. I am not living in mortal terror on a like an hour to hour, minute to minute basis. And so that also, yeah, there's something about the fragmentation, I think, of the identity that's also just, I mean, it's not a coincidence. It's intentionally done. But I think that's something that comes up for me too a lot, is like to think of the ways to like keep reasserting existence and presence in the face of these larger reaches that are happening. And then like, what do you do once you've reasserted that? Like, how are you then being I think this is like, it comes up in my writing. I mean, I have never, the last year and a half, I've engaged in kinds of writings that I've never engaged in because I've never had interest in. There was never any need for it. It's not, I'm not a journalist. I'm not, you know, an op-ed-y nonfiction kind of person, but that's what like the moment called for. Mm-hmm. And so that's also really, you know, like then you're like, okay, this is what I'm doing now. Like, yeah.
That's so interesting. Yeah. And as I was listening to you, I was thinking about the first chapter of Salt Houses and how we begin by looking at how our circumstances define what living is.
Yes, 100%. 100%. Yeah, and I think there's something in this idea of like really thinking about what it means to who gets entitled to what kind of life and how, you know? And then if you have enough time and space to like navel gaze, like if you're even asking that question, you got a lot of privilege, right? So it's like to have this conversation, it's like, oof, we got so much, not just like the ability of time or internet or access or whatever, but I mean, even just like the ability to have enough stillness in one's life internally and externally to be able to ponder and wonder aloud and not know, like that is such a, that might be the biggest privilege of all, right? Like to have enough space and capacity internally and externally to be able to attend to your life in that way is like, that's the privilege.
Yeah. To be able to step back, because I do, and this is totally my imagination. I do imagine that my great grandmother, who was a migrant farmer during the Dust Bowl, who was barely surviving, who was literally creating a home every couple of months out of whatever little scraps she could find as they moved from crop to crop, as she was out there picking in the fields, she was pondering. She was contemplating, how is my husband talking to me? Are my kids okay? Right.
Like that is part of the human condition, right? Is to be like thinking and wondering and like storytelling. Yeah. You see that? I mean, that's very true. Yeah. Like the fact that like, it's not like oral tradition of storytelling or poetry or music or art stops.
Right.
In times of like oppression or despair.
No. Yeah. And the privilege to be able to step back and say, is this working for me?
Well, and also like, I guess that you're right. It might be just more the step back and the ability to be like, and if it's not, I can probably do something about that situation.
Yeah, I have some agency and authority here.
You know what I mean? As opposed to like, you know, millions upon millions of people around the world where it's like that agency is continuously infringed upon. And so when you have a play, you know, like, like somewhere like Gaza, where it's like been besieged for, you know, 18 years, where it's like, you know, like there's no freedom of mobility, like where a body goes, what you have access to, what you're able to do, the regulations. I mean, things like, you know, it's like illegal to collect rainwater, you know, it's illegal to go fish. It's illegal to like things where it's like your access to be able to like
choice
to govern the ungovernable is like such a tenet, I think, of like oppressive forces, you know, to like find ways to be like, even rainwater, we can have policies about. And you're like, what are you talking about?
But, right.
Yeah. But you're right. It is, it's the stepping back and then being like, I have, you know, we were just talking about this before we started recording where it's like, so what are we going to do? What are we, you know, like, where do I want to live?
Raise
where
my
do
daughter?
I want to leave? Where do I want to, whatever? Yeah. Where do I want to raise a kid? Like that to even have that conversation presupposes that I have the freedom of mobility and enough access to resources and enough access to internal resources to be like, and if I wanted to go somewhere, I could figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like that is not something to take lightly.
It's freedom. I love this as an intro to your memoir.
We really just went. Yeah. We don't like, really.
I mean, and yet
it's all connected. It's all connected.
Yeah.
You're right.
And so interestingly, your book is called I'll Tell You When I'm Home. And you've said that motherhood has felt like a kind of home for you. And I just interviewed for the show very recently, Christina Jimenez, who wrote the book Dreaming of Home.
Yes.
With very, very similar and yet wildly
incredibly similar themes. Yes.
Yes. And so home, as somebody who recently moved, has been on my mind a lot. The person who most felt like home for me recently passed. And so of these themes are so meaningful to me right now. And your family history has directly been marked by displacement and exile. And now you are making a home for your daughter.
Trying to, Yeah. First of all, I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Especially
to lose people that feel like landing, like that they're just like shelters is really devastating. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I think there is something about the, like writing the book. I think it was an interesting experience in that I have never written something while it was happening. Like I think in general, the advice we give writing students and ourselves and whatever is like, you wait a beat, you give your system a chance to like process that a thing has happened, you know, or like
teach from your scars, not your wounds.
Experience. Exactly. Yeah. If it's too raw, you can't get a little bit of distance from it. And I think this was one of those situations where just because of the demands of like, I had sold a book on a partial, a nonfiction project. It was supposed to be essays. It kind of started morphing into something more memoristic. I was on a deadline. I moved the deadline once. I just couldn't do it again. Like it was like, we just had to have something in. And then it became kind of clear that what I was currently living in was going to make a compelling narrative. And that I thought was kind of the primary thing. And then that became secondary because the primary thing became that it was also incredibly powerful to write through it. So that's what it was. It wasn't even like writing in hindsight to process a thing. It was like literally writing to walk myself through a thing, mm-hmm. which is a very particular kind of experience. And and that became a sort of homemaking in and of itself, because to be able to find a coherent narrative of what my life has been, you know, and what I want to take of it for my daughter and how I want to be able to pass along and what I want to retain and what I want to discard. That's such an emotional kind of nesting, you know, like for trying to, you know, trying to get ready to welcome a new life in, is like to really think about things like inheritance and what we want to keep and what we want to leave and how did we get here and what have we learned and like that. So it's like, I didn't do any of that stuff physically, you know, because I was like in the same apartment in Williams or the same one I'm in right now, like the whole time. But I think there was definitely a real kind of like taking stock and like excavation and like what is going to stay here on these larger scales. And that ended up including questions of like the marriage that I was in, you know, like what is going to stay, what is going to go. But there's no way to know that that was happening while it was happening. Because at the time I was just like, I got to get a draft in. I need to find a cool structure for the story. Like, okay, my daughter's been born. I want to be able to write about that. Like, so it was just such a, this book has been so interesting because it was such a pain in the ass to write, because if for so long I couldn't figure out what it was going to be. And I just felt the tick tock of like, you know, I'm running out of time. And then it was really interesting to launch because I was so dissociated, which was like kind of the perfect headspace to launch a book. Incidentally, is like what's happening right now, because the stakes feel like nothing, right?
Yeah.
Like if the stakes,
a book launch in another time, like, would have felt like the biggest, craziest.
Now I'm just like, people are being like, there is a famine, stage 5 famine, forcibly imposed on 2 million people. Like that, like there's, the stakes are so different right now that it really put things in perspective. Actually, it was kind of like, you know, if someone likes it, they like it. If they don't like it, they don't like it. If I connect with someone over it, amazing. Like it's all like, particularly the things that might've felt like bumps in the road have so easily been absorbed now, where I'm just like, well, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And so I think that, so all this is to say, like the creating process was really uncomfortable. The launching and touring of it felt a little bit dissociated. You know, I was kind of outside of my body the whole time. But now it's been a few months, and in the aftermath, something interesting is happening where I'm like, I'm starting to work on a new project. And I'm just like, wow, that was really a gift. That experience, like that's really given me, like it was giving me clarity about things in my life without me realizing it. Some things that didn't go into effect for a while. Because if I wrote the first draft of the book, it was maybe 4 years ago, I wasn't even realizing what I had written towards, particularly in relationship to these larger questions of Palestinianness. Because I think then when October 7th happened, I just spent a couple of years really diving into like my family history and asking myself these questions of like what it meant to be diasporic and what does it mean to be inside and outside of a thing. And yeah, so then like all of these things happened, and I was like, oh, I've kind of been prepping for it.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because just before we hopped on to record, we were talking about these moments where we feel a sense of restlessness in ourselves. And the only certainty is that we are not settled.
100%. Yeah. There's not going to be like, yeah.
And I hear that in this prior time too. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like you're back in that phase again.
I think that's sort of where I feel. Yeah. And that's also part of like, that's also kind of what happens when you're starting a project. So also I think like creatively, I'm at the beginning of a thing again. And that's always like weird and kind of insecure and kind of cute and kind of, you know, but I think there is something on a life level given what we were just talking about, like, where do I want to live? Where do I want to raise this child? Like, where do I want to take a child that is half Palestinian? Where do I want her to be able to have access to her, both her culture, and that culture means multiple things in this case, right?
And
I'm sort of back to the drawing board, which I guess is the core facet of what it means to be alive, right? Is to continuously be back to the drawing board. I'm like back to not knowing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't, and who knows what has been put into place in terms of the book or in terms of conversations like these, I mean, you can have a random conversation with a stranger and that will change the course. I really believe that. Right. And so it's like, I've been kind of more than usual trying to pay attention to the little, I don't know, like the, what would otherwise just seem as like chance encounters. But like now, so when you were telling me about your move, I was like, huh, that's interesting. Do you have a vision? Like, is there some, it doesn't have to be that clear, but what is it like if you could distill it into a moment or a sound or, a visual, like what would that be? Yeah. Like 2 years ago, I would have just been like, oh, that's really cool. Now I'm like, huh, interesting.
What is
that? I want to sit with that. Like everything feels more like potent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like what we are tuned into.
Yes.
With our station. Yes. Yeah. I think too, our history teaches us so much about how to weather these things. And so what I hear in your response that I find so potent is this reminder that the not knowing isn't something to run from.
Exactly.
Right? Because we can, get so scared of like not knowing that we just retreat back into the familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I hear you having done, and now maybe embarking on doing again, is saying, I don't know. How exciting is that? Like, yeah. I'm going to wake myself up and start to pay attention and find the little breadcrumbs that lead me.
I think there's something in like, it's not even trust, it's data. It's like, because I'm not a great trust or faith-based person. Like I can get really like, but how do you know? But also like, here's 10 examples of times it didn't work out, you know? But I think there's something about like the older you get, even in psych research, there's a reason why people commit suicide less in like middle age. And then the caveat here would, it spikes again, particularly for white cis men in 60s and 70s. So just caveat there.
Interesting.
But for like women, for example, like, or, you know, cis women, or there's limited, you know, research is still being done on other groups, but like for many other people, there's this risk that occurs in adolescence that then does start to go down a little bit,
mm-hmm.
even in people that are prone to suicidality. And one of the like theories of that is that you haven't lived a lot of life yet.
Yeah, you don't have evidence.
And so when something really painful happens, you don't have fucking evidence that it will end.
Right.
You know what I mean? You get your heart broken at 14 or 15 or 16. You're like, this is the rest of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
This is just it, man. You get your heart broken at 39 and you're like, this fucking sucks. And now I'm probably going to lose 2 years to this bullshit. And who knows how I'm going to rebuild it. And I don't even like who I am as I'm like dealing with this, whatever, you know what I mean? Like it's a different, like, but it's not, but you're not like, and I will never not feel this way again.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it's exactly it. It's evidence. And I think that evidence really, so there's that's a little bit of it for me. It's like uncertainty. I'm like, it's the evidence that like, there's nothing that's permanent.
Right.
Nor is uncertainty going to be permanent. And so you're just kind of like, you know, honey, even if you do nothing, at some point, an answer is going to come along.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It might take longer, you know, than if you're like mindfully, really willfully in the world and like asking these questions of yourselves and having these conversations. But even if you don't do nothing, eventually something will, you'll get like a random job offer, or you will get kicked out of a country, or you will get invited to another one. Or, you know what I mean? Like something,
there will be a forcing function.
Something will happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's also one of the things that I have come to rely on, where I'm just like, you know, nothing can stay like this.
No. It's like, what's the right thing for right now?
Yeah. So be cozy in the shittiness. I am kind of big on just like, get cozy in the unpleasantness. Mm. It's fine. And again, like, you know, I want to like circle back to what we were saying earlier about privilege. That's a super privileged thing to say. Yes. And that was really within the context of like certain circumstances, right?
Right.
But like for the kind of circumstances that I think you and I are talking about, like, I have the capacity to get cozy in the not knowing and in the kind of day-to-day achy discomfort of just being like, what next? Mm-hmm. Just get, just like buckle, you know, bunker down.
Interesting what you were saying too about that research, because I was just looking at research yesterday that theoretically, right, like they're still really, they're still digging into the research, but there is an indication that women in their 40s actually have a peak in their growth mindset capacity.
I would believe that. Well, I think there is.
And I think it's very much linked.
Connected to those two things. And I think also like perimenopause and menopause, like there's like mental health actually tends to improve after menopause. Like there's all these like physical discomforts. And I think the road there can be rocky, obviously, for in different ways with hormonal changes. But like, yeah, like women, and there's a lot of quote unquote like DSM disorders, including things like dependent personality disorder or borderline personality disorder or whatever, where, yeah, like the data shows like middle age, like a lot of those traits start to stabilize. You know, a lot of the, well, because a lot of them intersect with social norms.
Gathered a bunch of data. Yeah.
But also the you know what I mean? So like, yeah, if you're like, you know, if there's like a terror of abandonment or like a desire to be validated by people or whatever, like that's really backed up by being told that your worth is whether you have those things, you know? Uh-huh. And then I think there is this kind of interesting talk about freedom, where it's like, yeah, I think like the older women get, and we're speaking in the binary now, but like, I think a lot of times there is kind of a, yeah, I mean, whether you like to or not, the social norms shift for you. Uh-huh. And what's expected for you shifts, you know, and that like, I think can be incredibly haunting and can, it can feel like a lot of grief for some people, but I think it also feels like liberation for some people.
It's all freeing, which again goes full circle back to where we began.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're a storyteller.
I would hope so.
Like, there's our unifying theme across all domains. You are a storyteller. So as a mother, and you've referenced this several times, and I just want to dig into it a little bit, you are very consciously right now making decisions about what to tell your daughter.
Yes.
About her inheritance.
Yes.
And her potential in the world. Mm-hmm. And so how are you thinking about that? What are you choosing to tell her? What do you most want her to understand?
I mean, I will say that there's a little cowardly part of me that has been so grateful the last 2 years that my daughter is too young to have some of the conversations that I know friends of mine with older kids are having about Palestine, about Gaza, but that will not last forever. I'm going to have to, you know, and I think I'm not a big fan of doing too much editing or too much sugarcoating. I think there's ways that if you keep things age appropriate, like you can be truthful with children. I think they deserve and can handle the truth. And I think that, yeah, I don't want to pretend to her that the world is a just place. And I don't want to pretend to her, I don't want to like feign a sense of equity or downplay my or her privileges or the privileges of likely a lot of people she's going to be in like, you know, daily contact with. I want her to be someone that thinks about service, and I want her to be somebody that thinks about how to show up for people. And I want her to be someone that the flip side of that is like to know that like they're like the antidote to that, I think, real deep existential loneliness that everybody feels at some point or another, is in the connections we make. You know, it's in being able to turn to each other. It's in being able to, like, everybody wants to be witnessed, right? Everybody wants to be seen. But like, I really believe that the act of witnessing and the act of seeing is just as, if not more, transformative for even for the person doing the witnessing. Like, it's, there's something in the, there's such a bi-directionality there to look at something, to take in something, and to be moved and changed by it. Like, those are the moments that I feel most connected to humanity in general, you know, whether that's through art or through just like a conversation with somebody or whatever. Like, so I hope to be able to give her enough experiences of that in her childhood that it becomes, it's like when a kid is, you know, adopted, or in our case, like, you know, we used surrogates. So it's like the ideal is that the kid never remembers being told that information. That's a lot of like the parenting advice is like that you're like, there isn't some big conversation where they remember being told that this huge thing, you know,
it's just a part of their identity.
It's a part of their, the mythology of the family. It's a part of their own mythos. It's a part of like just what it is. And like, they just always know it, and they've heard it in different ways. And
did you say mythos?
But I think there's something. Yes.
That's so cute. That's so good.
I don't even think that's a word.
I like it.
It's funny because as I said it, I was like, I'm going to just keep going. I'm just going to keep it going because I don't think that's actually a word that exists in any language.
It's a missing word.
It sounds like it should.
It really does. I was like, wait.
I doubled down on my mistake. I'm like, and it should. And it's actually the world's fault that it doesn't exist.
I called it out not to say.
Oh, no, it was an admiration. And I really say, appreciated like, that.
Wait, yeah. Where is this missing? Like, where have I been missing this word all along? Yes.
That's really funny.
I hope that's in a book.
I do, but I think there is something where it's like similarly, like, you know, you want her to know where she's come from in all these different ways. I want her to know these things and to it. Like, I want her not to, it's not like I want to take her at 7 and be like, listen, you're part of the world and you got to show up for it. You know, like, I want her to be doing and like engaging in the world and watching her caregivers do that and watching people that she loves and the grownups around her like already be doing that so that it just intuitively makes sense that that's how one would move through life.
Yeah, part of what underpins my question is I feel like you're helping her see the world.
Right.
We were talking about this like great privilege to be able to choose. And of course, the other side of that is not being able to choose, which is so linked up with like a victimization.
Totally.
And everything happening to us. And so I feel like given where your two core areas of focus are right now, there has to be an inherent challenge in teaching your child to be a leader in her own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to think about like the, and to, it's like both to teach her how to be, it's almost like, I almost pull back on that word because it just continues to play into like the individualistic, like almost like the hero archetype that like something lies just on my shoulders. Like which also in terms of activism or how we show up for causes, so it's like this idea that like, there's one person that's going to be able to solve that, you know, where it's like, no, that's not, you know, it's, you know, it's like connected to the no kings concept where it's just like, there isn't though, actually, that's not how it works. Like we show up for ourselves. We show up for each other. We protect us, you know? And I think it's like, I really want her to be able to take agency for the things she can take agency for. And the flip side of that is I want her to be able to take accountability for the things she needs to take accountability for. Cause I think that has become so, if there's any kind of theme that's really emerged in the last couple of years for me, kind of personally and like sociopolitically, it's this idea of accountability, of how we like societally suck at accountability, suck at the concept of like repair and amend making, and how we can allow people to do that. And like, you know, the idea that like to admit a wrong is not a sign of weakness, like the idea that like, that, you know,
badness. Like, to be
able to, yeah. And so if you can't present that coherently as a society, then you have what we want, which is like rampant like misuses and like abuses of power. Power is not going to be the thing that redlines itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets punch drunk and it's like, I want more and I want more and I want more. And that's, I think, what we're watching in like very intense detail right now. And so there's a lot of that for me, it starts with things as basic as like how we raise our children, you know, and like, what are we modeling for our kids about? Like, is this life just a zero sum game? And like, if you have a piece of the pie, that means one less piece of the pie for me. So I want that piece of pie. Like, you know, like, what are we communicating to these little human beings that are eventually, this is their world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think accountability has become, I think I've always been sort of like an like annoyingly kind of like just disoriented person in ways that make me insufferable, I think, in interpersonal relationships. But like, I think like I've become really like, it's, I'm really soaking it in lately, where I'm just like, I think this is everything. Actually, I think what we're talking about when we have these larger conversations is like how to be accountable for your life, you know, and accountable for the things you can be accountable for, and to be unafraid to do that. And then again, bidirectionally, to be able to offer people the grace for them to be able to do it for their own lives and their own things. Like, that's so crucial.
We're
fucked otherwise.
Absolutely. And I think it is, again, I go back to that word engagement.
Yeah.
And I think we can get so overwhelmed by the size and scale of the problem.
Yes.
That we get a little too cozy.
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
We're like, I'm going to go hide under the bed and hope it all goes away. And that's really the danger. But that can't happen when we are accountable.
That's right.
When we are present, when we are awake, when we engage. And just dip our little toes in. Slightly comfortable way. Yeah.
That's right.
It's interesting too, as I talk to you, I heard you once say that you were obsessed with the mundane.
Yeah.
I certainly see that in your characters, that it's like through mundane moments and actions, we both see and feel our universality, but we also find these bigger themes. And I feel like I've heard you do this already 50 times in 37 minutes. And you were, of course, nominated for this show by the incomparable Mahogany L. Brown. I can't.
Dream of dreams.
Literally, I just like want to swim.
Just an incredible God. And just like talk about presence. Talk about like the consistent, unflinching willingness to just like attend to what's at hand. Like that is her. And so unflappable. I mean, maybe she's flappable in certain times in her life. I haven't seen it. I've never seen her be flat. You know what I mean? Like just so like, my nervous system just fucking regulates when I'm around her. It's if I'm in the room with her, I'm like, I can we got this. And that's really a powerful gift to be able to offer people. It's like calm a person's nervous. I would love to be able to do that, to calm people's nervous system when I enter a room. I don't think I have that effect.
And we need those mentors. And I think it's why we need stories so desperately.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
So who would you nominate for the Uplifters podcast?
So I nominated Sahar Terejani, is a Iranian. I mean, she has done the most incredible work. She's a beautiful novel out, gorgeous writer, but more recently has also been writing more nonfiction and is just this like fierce advocate, for human rights in general, but particularly for Iran and Iranian human rights, and just has this way of, being able to kind of like has a similar thing as Mahogany, where it's like, it's just is like, I'm going to keep returning to this moment. And I'm going to keep returning to these causes that I care about as bravely, as unflinchingly, with as much courage and as much clarity in my voice and in my writing as I can. And so she's also a good friend of mine. So it's like that combo of like both friend and someone that you're like, yes, I love how you're moving through the world is really like beautiful.
Yeah. I've made it a big commitment in my life to surround myself with people I admire.
That's a wonderful, wonderful like guiding light for friendship.
It really makes for a clear filter. So you've done a lot, you're doing a lot, you're being a lot. Where are you investing your energy right now that you want to invest more energy in?
I think I'm investing a lot in mothering, and I want to kind of keep that going.
Yeah.
I feel good about where I'm, that's really been like that's the sort of compass these days. And then I do think there's something about like the creative work. Like I would really like to ritualize my writing again. I think I had a really nice ritual and routine for the longest time, and I kind of lost it around COVID. I kind of lost it when I was writing the memoir because it was a difficult book to have like a routine around. And I think now I'm like, I really want to invest in that. And then I'm like really excited about learning more about different art forms. Like I do a lot of collaging. I've been doing like rhizo printing and playing around with different visual art stuff. And like I'd like to try to take that a little bit more seriously.
Cool. Be a beginner. So as uplifters, we love to lift up others. Yeah. So how can we as a community support you and your work right now?
You know, I don't even know. Buy the book if you'd like. I'm notoriously terrible at marketing.
Buy the book.
If you feel like it. No pressure. Yeah.
Buy the book and then buy it for someone else.
Or like take it out of the library or something, you know?
Yeah. Or listen to it on Audible.
And then if you're in New York, I do like a reading, writing, music series called Kanya Makan. Give that a follow.
Ooh.
If you follow me on Instagram, I always post about it, but it also has its own Instagram. And we bring amazing, we raise funds every time. All the funds go straight to whatever mutual aid we're doing that particular month. We just did a beautiful fundraiser for Sudan. And it's really like lovely. There's an open mic and there's music and there's poets and fiction writers and memoirists. And it's really lovely.
That's really lovely. I want that in my life. I'm going to go look at it right now.
And I think, I mean, sort of like, it's, you should come. You should definitely
come.
I'm so
coming.
There's one on Friday, actually.
It was really great talking to you, Hala.
This was a delight. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the Uplifters in your life and then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more Uplifters. And it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwell in the perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up. Lift you up, whoa. Whoa, lift you up. Whoa, lift you up.
Beautiful.
I cried.
It's that little thing you did with your voice.
Right, in the pre-chorus, right? Uh-huh.
I was like...
Mommy, stop crying. Mommy, stop crying. You're disturbing the peace.